Greetings, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the first ever episode of the Nonaligned Media Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Martinez. I, together with Joshua Blakeney, founded Nonaligned Media, which is a news and commentary website aimed at cutting through the spin and deception of mainstream media and deciphering truth in history. We at Nonaligned Media are not shackled by political correctness, nor are we driven by any one political ideology or philosophy. We hold dear the principles of freedom of speech and freedom of inquiry without any restrictions or reservations. The website address is nonalignedmedia.com, where you can subscribe to all of our updates via email. And if you wish to support our efforts by donating, you are more than welcome to do so. On that note, I'd like to introduce my very special guest. And her name is Deanna Spingola, whom some of the listenership may be familiar with, although she doesn't get nearly the amount of recognition that she deserves. Deanna is a prolific writer and author of a trilogy of books entitled The Ruling Elite. She has also hosted her own radio show for many years, interviewing perhaps hundreds of people on a wide array of issues and subjects that the mainstream or lamestream media refuses to address in any meaningful way. It's a great privilege to have you on the first episode of Nonaligned Media. How are you today?
I'm very well, and you?
I'm doing quite good. I first wanted to ask you, since you're pretty much a historian, you've written three books and are writing another one. So I just wanted to get into, you know, the art of writing history. I think it's okay for historians to sort of have a bias, so long as the bias is aimed at, you know, revealing truths and uncovering injustice and pursuing like a righteous path. But unfortunately, so many historians today, they're simply not interested in that. They exemplify what many would call court historians, who are basically glorified as stenographers who have been basically commissioned by those in power to jot down the victor's version of events and to suppress inconvenient truths that threaten the prevailing narrative, right? And then this affords them great privilege in society. They get prestigious awards and they're promoted in the mainstream media and just given a lot of praise by the establishment. So, when you write a book about history, how do you approach it? Do you approach it from a particular perspective, or do you take like a bird's eye view type of approach where you just let the facts do the talking? Or how do you approach when you write a history book?
I attempt to look at both sides, because as you say, the victor usually writes the history. They're always biased. Many of them end up on the New York Times bestseller list. They're usually written by court historians, people associated with academia in some manner. And of course, a lot of them are associated with the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, after World War II, the Council on Foreign Relations defies their own history of World War II. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been interested in history. It was my favorite subject in school. I read about history just in my own. In my own spare time. I was an avid reader. I was kind of a loner. I had a growing library at the age of 11. I had a library.
Wow.
And it's grown quite a bit bigger since then. And so I had read, for instance, with regard to World War II, wow, I had read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Scherer, and I read several books pertaining to World War II. He wrote probably three or four. I read all of his books, and then I read other books, and I'm thinking, gosh, these Germans were really evil people.
Right.
And then I thought, and these Jews, they were really stupid. Why would they allow themselves to be hauled off to the gas chambers and put into the gas ovens?
Right.
I thought, gosh, are they that lacking in courage that they would allow this?
Right.
It just didn't seem that should be the way it was. Now, I grew up in California, and I knew some some Jews, and the husband was kind of henpecked, and I thought, well, maybe all the Jews are like that, and I just wasn't sure, and so I did continue to believe that that the Germans were evil monsters,
right?
And
well, that's the prevailing narrative. That's
sure.
You know, Napoleon said, you know, official history is simply a set of fables agreed upon by the victorious power. So
sure.
Basically, the academic establishment of the Western world, the reason they demonize Hitler and portray Hitler as the ultimate evil is basically because he lost the war. And if he didn't lose the war, there'd be quite a different narrative being proffered by these people.
Sure. But of course, the problem with Germany didn't begin with Hitler. There was always a problem with Germany. The Jews always had a problem with Germany from 1848 forward because of the Marxist revolutions throughout Europe. So it wasn't something that just started with Hitler
yeah.
coming to power in January of 1933.
Right. So, you know, the people such as yourself who question the prevailing narrative are called conspiracy theorists or revisionists, but revisionism is absolutely essential and core to the art of writing history. I mean, you can't know what went on unless you look back and gather the evidence, and perhaps new evidence becomes available later on that you didn't have before, and you have to revise what you wrote, right? I mean, that's just
sure.
a basic tenet of writing history. But, you know, revisionism has taken on this, it's like a dirty word now, and
sure.
you're called a revisionist, you're basically a heretic. And, you know, in the days of when the Catholic Church was reigning, they, you know, called people heretics, and Galileo was basically tortured because he didn't go along with the church doctrine that the Earth was the center of the solar system, and look at what happened after that. I mean, that's an accepted truth now, and this is the same situation that's going on with World War II history, the most politicized epoch in all of our history. Still today, I mean, basically the world order that was established after World War II hinges upon this official narrative being upheld. And that's why you see today, even though there's differences between the Western powers and Russia and China today, they're unanimously in agreement that World War II revisionism needs to be suppressed. And that's why Vladimir Putin recently outlawed revisionism. He made, quote, Holocaust denial a crime in Russia, and which is what the Western powers have done. Other than the United States, most European countries do not allow any revision of the official story of World War II. And China also is against any kind of revising of World War II historiography, because they were part of the Allied powers, just as
sure.
as the Soviet Union was. So, and they have historical grievances with Japan and rivalry with Japan, so they, of course, need Japan to be portrayed as the evildoer and them as the virtuous victims. That's always the narrative that emerges. One of the main themes of my work and your work as well is critiquing Jewish exceptionalism and destructive impact of this faux religion or state religion that has been imposed on the world since the end of World War II. And this is this concept that Jews are above reproach, or above rebuke. They cannot be criticized. Their culture is faultless. Their history is spotless. And they're the ultimate perennial victims of history. This is, of course, an absurd fantasy. But this is the narrative that is proffered. You know, you can't criticize Israel or Jews, or you'll suffer ramifications. And
right.
So when did you become aware of this pervasive Zionist power?
I used to be part of that because, well, that's what everyone believed. And so I was of that opinion for some time. In fact, I went to Israel in 1999 And that's when I got my first glimpse of their ideology. And, I mean, it was just very revealing, incredibly revealing. And I went with a group of other people, and we were told not to mention any church, not to act like we're trying to impose any ideology upon them. And I saw the way that the Palestinians were treated, and that was in 1999. And we did go into the Palestinian areas, and gosh, I mean, it was so guarded. There were young troops, Israeli troops, everywhere. We went to the Jordan River. It was highly, highly guarded. And one of the things that's very interesting about the Jordan River is that it was just a trickle. And I'm thinking, I thought this was supposed to be some big river. And here it is, just a trickle, and the water's dirty, it's awful, it's terrible. And then I discovered that the Israeli state had blockaded the water, had dammed the water at a certain point so that it would benefit Israel at the expense of everyone else. And and the Palestinians were just, gosh, I just felt really sorry for them.
Yeah.
And
that's basically, if you want to view firsthand, you know, what human misery is like, and go to Gaza, go to West Bank, especially after this past ritual slaughter that took place, where Israel killed another 2,000 plus Palestinians in Gaza, injured over 15,000 or something,
right?
Destroyed entire cities. I've seen videos on the internet where the IDF literally leveled entire city blocks and destroyed every single apartment, hospital, schools. They're shooting at children. This is this mindless violence. And you know, one of the interesting things that I noticed is, you know, when we critique Israel, I think there's a lot of people that, you know, fall short of the mark, and especially people who have been hoodwinked by Marxism and communism. You'll notice that Marxists, there are still Marxists today, and communists, you can see them on the streets and protests, and they're waving their red flags. They will critique Israel, they will critique U.S. imperialism, but they will try to whitewash the nature of Jewish power. And the perfect example is when it comes to Israel. They will try to say that Israel is just doing the bidding of the United States, and the United States is somehow divorced from Jewish power, divorced from Zionist power. There's two problems with their narrative. One, they're ignoring the Zionist power configuration that has hijacked the American government. Secondly, you know, they're trying to proffer this mythology that basically the Jewish tradition was noble and good prior to 1948 and the state of Israel being formed, and somehow somewhere along the way it just went off course, and they're behaving like barbarians now, and this is just an aberration from the Jewish tradition. But when you really look into the history of it, that's completely false. In fact, the tradition has always been the opposite. That you know, we look into the history of Bolshevism in Russia, and we find the same people behind that. And this is the problem. These Marxists are following an ideology, which I recently wrote an article about this, that one of the key components and tenets of Marxist ideology is Jewish exceptionalism. It was an ideology fostered and spawned by Jewish thinkers such as Moses Hess and Karl Marx, and many Jews who have rabbinical lineage. It basically stems from Judaism. Mm-hmm. It is an ideology that was formed and formulated as sort of a group evolutionary strategy of Jews to dethrone or unseat Gentile rulers, aristocracies, you know, the Christian aristocracies in Russia and in Eastern Europe. and even Western Europe, this was the purpose of Marxism, was to, it was a false liberation ideology. It was basically a Jewish, an ethnicized Jewish plot to overturn systems of government that they didn't like, that they felt weren't conducive to Jewish power. And this is, so this is why Marxists and communists today cannot give us a good analysis of the power structure. They ignore the Jewish element of the power structure because they're the founders and ideological forebears of their ideology were Jews, and this is manifest today in the form of these false dissenters like Noam Chomsky and Norman Finkelstein and others who try to shift the blame, right? They try to divert the attention onto other groups. They cannot. They basically only critique Gentile capitalists, right? Gentile capitalists. They falsely portray the power structure in the West as being in the hands of Gentiles. That's what they do, right? Have you noticed that as well?
I have, but it goes back really further than that. It goes back all the way back to Columbus. I picked the Columbus, right. Was said to be a Jew, and even in this country, my second book, my third book, I get them all kind of confused, but even as far back as George Washington, there was Jewish power within the American government, which began in August of 1790 with good old President Washington. It was a year after his inauguration, and he visited Newport, Rhode Island, and the Jews from the local synagogue handed him a letter praising the God of Israel for establishing an unbiased government. Jewish religious schools still studied, they still study George Washington and view him as essential in granting Jewish freedom in America. And he wrote, George Washington wrote, and I quote, "The government of the United States of America, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it all, on all occasions, their effectual support," unquote. And that was a president setting letter, and it was the first, he was the first national leader in 17 centuries to regard the wandering Jews as free and equal fellow citizens.
Wow. Yeah, the subtitle of your second book is The Zionist Seizure of World Power. So you trace this pervasive and pernicious force back many, many centuries, and I didn't even know about that. So they have been trying to seize power for many centuries.
They have seized power.
Right.
For instance, in America, a lot of people think that Andrew Jackson was this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person who cast the bankers out and all of that. And he was one of the first presidents that made a deal with the Rothschild bankers to have them act as the correspondent bank in Europe. And it was his doing, his behavior, that brought about the crash of 1837. Mm-hmm. And when you look at some of the letters written during that administration, during the Jackson administration, then you kind of wonder, because he was the Secretary of State at the time was writing to the Rothschilds in England, to the bank, and saying that it was Jackson that permitted them to be the correspondent bank. And so all these things that we hear about Andrew Jackson being such a good guy, I mean, he was just one of the elite people that catered to the Jews.
Yeah.
And many people within the government at that time, in fact, there's one letter, I believe it's in my first book, that talks about, let me just find it here. when I write something down, I figure, okay, if I write it down, I don't have to remember it.
Right. Your books are extremely detailed, over 600 pages. You go through the history, a lot of American history. There's even history about the Ottoman Empire, and you basically trace this element of Jewish supremacism throughout the ages. It goes back many, many centuries, thousands of years, and you know, we hear about, you know, they always throw out this idea of persecution and discrimination, and this is such a hypocritical thing, because you know, look at how they treat Palestinians. They
sure.
are oppressing them. They are treating them like worse than cattle. You know, killing them indiscriminately,
sure.
Shooting children. Kevin Barrett has shown that the Israeli military deliberately kills children. That snipes children as they're
for throwing rocks and
even I've seen a
for
case.
Nothing.
I've seen a case of a young child in a classroom. A girl. She's about like 8 years old, sniped through a window. I mean, this is incredible depravity, and you know, they present themselves as the ultimate victims, as people who have been chased out of every country and persecuted wherever they went. But if we want to analyze the psychology behind that, it's like if I meet 20 people and at the end of the day, all 20 of them despise me and hate my guts, I think at some point you got to take a hard look in the mirror and say, well, what am I doing that's causing this animosity and this aversion towards me? Are just these 20 vastly different individuals with different upbringings? Is it their fault that they don't like me, or is it my fault? Maybe it's something I'm doing, and that's called
sure.
introspection. And it seems that within the Jewish culture, there is no introspection. They are absolutely opposed to any criticism, to any introspection, to any self-criticism. They are just completely self-righteous, always blaming the other for the issues that they then bring upon themselves. And this is one of the reasons why it's never going to change, because they can't criticize themselves, but it's not part of their culture. Right, it's not part of their tradition to do so. In fact, they basically cast out, even from within their own group, those that decide to criticize. Many Jews have criticized, you know, their elite and have produced a lot of good work exposing some of the machinations of the Zionist power elite, such as Benjamin Friedman. Who did that great speech in 1961.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
Those people are treated terribly. They're cast out. They're treated as lepers. So that is a cultural thing, and that goes back many centuries before the State of Israel was formed. So
that is how they stay cohesive, because Jews that see these things happening and think about even mentioning them recognize what will happen to them if they do. And that is because of the rabbis. The rabbis kept very strict control over the people. A lot of times people think, oh, look what the people have done. They put them in ghettos. No, the rabbis ghettoized them. And that was to keep them separate and pure and unadulterated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the rabbis that did that.
But it's like they have this double game that they're playing, where they'll officially they'll claim that the ghettoization thing is persecution, and that this was Christian bigotry and the Christians did this. But in fact, we look at their own tradition, and it is their tradition. This is a rabbinical tradition to try to isolate Jews so that they don't assimilate. That's one of the major concerns of the rabbinical class. In
mm-hmm.
Judaism is to make sure that Jews don't assimilate, because they think if they assimilate they will disappear eventually, right?
Sure. But one of the things that they did do in Frankfurt was the first city-state that actually emancipated them, and I talk about this in my first book. And they did this in about 1809, and it was Rothschild money that did this. They lived in the ghetto in Frankfurt. And there were probably 2,500 people in that ghetto. And they did lock it up at 5 o'clock at night, and then they unlocked it the next morning. And the Jews paid the tax that hired the guard to keep it locked, and they were able to get out and go and do their business wherever they wanted to do their business at during the day. And so they did have freedom, but then it was, like I say, Rothschild money and some political influence that he purchased that allowed them emancipation in Frankfurt. And as soon as that occurred, then, of course, other European states emancipated their Jews, and then within 30 or 40 years...
Well, I think one of the reasons that there was this tension between Christians and Jews in Europe, and that maybe that these Christian rulers felt that it was necessary to kind of keep them separate was
absolutely
because they felt that the Jews would become so dominant in certain industries, particularly the financial industry, that they would just push out any competition, and it would be a sort of a Jewish dictatorship in a sense, and that was of course a grave threat to Christian societies. And this is why they felt they needed to isolate them. So it's not this black and white. They were just persecuted simply because they were Jews. That's the only reason that they would. So there's a lot more to the story. But if you just go into a regular university history class, of course that's not what you're going to get. You're going to get Jews are absolute victims. Gentiles are absolute oppressors. That's the narrative, and that's what people have been fed since birth, which is why so many people are blind to these issues.
Sure.
What are some of the other areas of research that you've been involved with? Your second book, you cover a lot of the Zionist influence vis-a-vis the First and Second World War. That's something I've emphasized as well. And because if we don't break down the mythology surrounding these wars, then we can't really solve anything today, because we're living in this post-World War II New World Order.
Sure.
And the people who won World War II are in power today, and they're persecuting everybody.
Right. My second book deals with World War I, and my third book deals with World War II. And the first book was from the Civil War forward. So, it covered a little bit before the Civil War, because you have to give the reasons why the Civil War started, who started it, how the Marxists gained power during that war, because the Marxists from Europe, because they were unsuccessful in Europe in establishing Marxist power there, they came over to this country and established it here very, very thoroughly. They are the ones that really were influential in putting Lincoln into power, if not for the Marxists that came over and fought in the Union, on the Union side. It would have been quite different. And in fact, they, like I say, they were the ones that put him in power.
Yeah.
And,
Marxists, they're faux revolutionaries, they're pseudo radicals who essentially seek to depose those who, the Jewish supremacists want to unseat and cast aside. And, we see them only ever attacking societies and governments and social structures that are a threat to Jewish hegemony, right? So this is where the Frankfurt School and this cultural Marxism stems from. It's this this attempt to deracinate, de-ethnicize, to break down the foundational elements of Western societies in order to produce masses of just cultureless, identityless people who can't form a cohesive identity.
Sure.
And this provides those who want to seize power, who do have an ethnic identity, an extreme chauvinism and a supremacism within their culture, it gives them great leeway to be able to seize the institutions of the state and keep the rest of us held down. So this Frankfurt School, this is all part of the same agenda.
Sure, absolutely. And of course, they introduce multiculturalism into this country, and they are introducing it in every other country. And that's also one of the functions of warfare. And, of course, they were the people behind slavery. They owned the slave ships. They ran the slave markets. And so they saw immediately, early on, the productivity, the profit in dealing with, well, human trafficking,
yeah,
which is what, and they're still doing it. Now they're trafficking organs and all kinds of other things.
Right. These, you know, they it's almost like they're, you know, have this agenda behind it, but they're also making money off of it. So it's like this, it's such a profitable thing for them. Like they can increase their capital while breaking down the rest of society.
Sure.
And you know, the multiculturalism thing is interesting. I mean, you know, when we there's a huge hypocrisy involved. You know, the Zionists in Israel are the absolute opposites of being tolerant or multicultural. They want to keep out anybody who's not Jewish. It's calls itself the Jewish state. It engages in ethnic cleansing. It was formed through the ethnic cleansing of Arabs and the destruction of over 500 Arab villages and decimation of their society.
And
their immigration policy is one of an absolute iron wall around the whole country. And then, in fact, recently a video emerged showing that the Israeli government is rounding up African immigrants that are going to Israel for jobs, and the Israeli government has put them in essentially prison camps and is looking to deport them. So the mainstream media in the West is schizophrenic in the sense that it defends these extreme like racial supremacists in Israel, and then at the same time is pushing an extreme egalitarian and multicultural agenda for the rest of the world. And this is part of the divide and conquer strategy. They get to be extreme chauvinists, extremely ethnocentric, sticking to their own, keeping everybody out. And then in the West, you know, open borders, everybody can come here,
sure,
you know, mixed together. And this is part of breaking down the culture and identity of the different countries that they seek to subjugate.
Sure. Absolutely. And like I say, they started early on. When you look at Emma Lazarus, who wrote the poem for the Statue of Liberty. And the Statue of Liberty, of course, was created by Freemasons in France, and that was their gift to the United States, because the United States was successful in establishing a country that would allow the Marxist Jewish influence to come in and rule. And a lot of people say, well, gosh, they're not ruling, but they failed to recognize not only the number of Jews that have been in Congress since about 1850, but they failed to recognize that just about everybody in Congress is placed there because of the finances of the Jews, the campaign finances that they get, and they get it through various corporations. And what happened with the Civil War is that it actually established a corporatocracy, and the corporations are a monopoly. They're untouchable. And when you look at the board of directors for each of the corporations, you'll find that many of them share the same members, and it's a monopolization. And those same corporations, of course, are many of them are multinational. And the other way that they rule is through the drug trade. And I mentioned they dealt in organ trafficking as well as human trafficking, sex, and otherwise, the slave trade. They also are the people behind the drug trade. And it goes all the way back to the opium wars in China, because they find that, gosh, a population is much, much easier to control if they're all doped up. And so you find that they're using that today in this country. And then when you look at say, for instance, the Vietnam War and the war in Afghanistan, those are absolutely, totally drug wars.
Yeah.
So, to, open up the illegal trade, and then, of course, they are also in charge of the so-called legal drugs, pharmaceutical industry.
Now, I guess, like, during the Cold War, this McCarthyite era in the United States where Senator McCarthy was hunting down communist infiltrators in the U.S. government, do you view that as sort of a pushback against this communist, Jewish communist element, or was that something else?
No. Roosevelt allowed the... But they didn't infiltrate. They just stepped in, and Roosevelt put them all into government positions. He made a deal with the Soviets the minute he got into power, and he was a communist. In fact, in my second book, or my third book, I referred to him, let me just tell you what I referred to him. I think I referred to him as the Red in the White House. And he was definitely a communist, had communist sympathies, and as did his wife. And when you read about some of the people that they hung around with and some of the organizations that they were involved with, oh my gosh, these people really, they invited the communists to take over the government, and that's what they did. And then Truman, after Roosevelt died, Truman took over and pretty much finished reconfiguring the entire government formation. I mean, just allowed the bureaucracy to take over, where you had a lot of the bureaucratic groups who were making a lot of decisions that had absolutely nothing to do with the American with American liberty. And
so you view McCarthy as somebody who was trying
He had the right idea, yeah, absolutely.
Right, and you know, the whole issue is always diverted by disinformation. People want to invoke boogeymen such as the Jesuits or the Vatican or other groups, and you know. There's some truth to the fact that the Vatican had power 300, 400, maybe 500 years ago.
Sure, they lost it.
Right, and today the power structure, which these people deny, is overwhelmingly Jewish Zionist. That's just a fact, and that's just some people have to come to terms with. But there's so many theories and memes out there that try to throw the blame onto somebody else, and this is all part of the program. Now, the World War II area is fascinating. I wouldn't say I'm an expert in it. But, you know, the common perception, that which you'll get if you go to a university or a regular high school, is that the war started when Hitler invaded Poland. Now, I've looked at this claim. First of all, the notion being advocated here, being advanced here, is that Britain and France were concerned about Polish sovereignty, that they cared about Polish independence and sovereignty.
No, they said they cared.
This can't be true when we look at the chain of events leading to the declaration of war by Britain against Germany. When after Hitler invaded Western Poland, but then 2 weeks later, the Soviets invaded Eastern Poland, and
right.
This wasn't an issue, apparently, for the Allied powers. So that kind of destroys the mythology that that the war started because of Poland. And not only that, but after the war, we find that Poland was completely swallowed by the Soviet Union, as was half of Europe. And
sure.
The Allies didn't have much to say about that either. So they had to invent this post-facto justification for the war, because if Poland wasn't the real issue, which is what the initial claim was, then what was the issue? Why did we sacrifice all this blood and resources to fight this brutal war if it wasn't over Poland's? And this is where the Holocaust story comes in, to provide the Allies with their casus belli to justify all of their actions during the war, Right, that's...
Well, the actual war started in the spring of 1933 with an economic assault against Germany by international Jewry. And that is when the war started. And as far as Poland, Poland was 10% Jewish. Mm-hmm. And most of them lived in the urban cities. Very, very few people, Jews, lived in out in the country. And those that did usually exploited the farmers and became the middlemen. In other words, they didn't do any work at all, but they would purchase the goods from the farmers and resell them and make money that way. But it actually started with the economic assault. And that was something that world Jewry did. There were factions in Britain. There were also factions in this country. And pretty soon there were factions all over. Because one thing about the Jews that we must absolutely acknowledge is the fact that they have an international unity. And they always have had, because they were the first to develop or to exploit or to take over the communication system, which they did well way before World War I. The Jews had taken over the cable business. They were kind of, you know, they took over a UPI and the API, mm-hmm. and they were in charge of Wolfs, and they pretty much owned the press in Europe and in this country also. Yeah. And so, and that was before World War I. By 1915, they had control of the New York Times. They had control, and they also had the service wherein they would disseminate the news to all the other newspapers in the country, so that they were in control of the yeah. population's perceptions, right. And so.
that's of course essential if you want to brainwash a population into
right.
participating in a war that they have absolutely no interest in participating
right.
in. And that this is where I think we people need to look into, you know, what Henry Ford was saying, and Father Charles Coughlin and others of those men standing who were saying that this European war, both World War I and World War II, was completely not in the interest of Americans, and certainly it wasn't in the interest of anybody who fought in that war. The only people who benefited from the Second World War were the international financiers and the military-industrial complexes of the various participants in the war, and those are the people who benefit from every major war. You know, people are always told that, you know, basically that there's one evil side in World War II. I mean, the Axis were the evil and we're the good and we're righteous and we were saving the world and we were liberating Europe for the cause of freedom. But in fact, the reality is that the war ended up enslaving half of Europe to communism. The rest of the Western Europe was basically enslaved to American hegemony, and then we had this unipolar world where we're having most of the world is having to choose between either this parasitic finance capitalist type of system emanating from the U.S. or the communist totalitarian system,
and they control both.
Right?
Ever since the takeover of Russia,
it was a false choice being proffered, and that was one of the purposes of World War II, and nobody knows the history of, you know, what led to the war. They don't know that, you know, the reason Adolf Hitler ever existed and the reason he got in the position that he eventually took hold of was because in World War I there was this so-called stab in the back, where the Zionist leaders made made a deal with Britain in that they would get that Britain would acquire Palestine as a national home for the Jews in exchange for the Zionists bringing America into the war on Britain's side to defeat Germany. And this, you know, this is something that Hitler argued. And you know, I'm not saying I agree with everything Hitler did or said, but you know, the mainstream, the nonsensical narrative is that everything, 100% of what Hitler claimed was false, was wrong. And if you even suggest that maybe he was right about anything, then you must be a neo-Nazi, right? But the fact, that's just a fact of history. He knew about that, and that was one of the justifications that he used for interning Jews in concentration camps. And when we look at that issue, you know, the mainstream historians will say that was a horrible act of internment. But the internment of people happened across the board. It happened in America, where Japanese, Germans, Italians were interned. Happened in Canada, right?
Sure. But that whole thing with Europe was under various royal families. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. And World War I was actually used also to break up the Ottoman Empire, to break up the royal family system, and to install governments that they could then control. The others, I mean, there's several factions, several reasons why they want war. One is to make a lot of money. The other is to get rid of a lot of people that they don't like. And the other is to disperse other peoples, to get them to move around, to leave their country. For instance, after World War II, a lot of Germans went to Canada, a lot of Germans went elsewhere. People move around, and it displaces people. It makes people feel insecure. And so you have all these various reasons that they do this, and also to open up the world to global power, to get everybody to say, oh gosh, we don't want this anymore. We just have to have peace. So we're going to have some sort of a unified government, a world government, and that's of course the other reason. I mean, there's so many reasons. And the reason, as you mentioned, the concentration camps, the first one opened in 1933, and that was because the Jews had declared warfare against Germany. And so there was a lot of communist infiltration in Germany from 1916 forward, where the communists were trying to do in Germany what they had done in Russia. And I mean, it was terrible. They'd taken over whole cities, and so they had communist enemies right within their midst, and most of those enemies just happened to be Jews. And so as soon as there was an official declaration of warfare in 1933, then of course you're going to round up your enemies, because they're right there in your country, you know, doing all kinds, blowing up buildings and doing all kinds of things, and you're going to put them where they can't do make any more trouble, and so that the population won't go after them also. So it was for their safety as well as to keep them incarcerated from doing harm. And they did not round up. Some people have the idea that they rounded up every single Jew, and that is not the case. They only rounded up those that were deemed a problem, those that had indicated whose side they were on as far as the communist power. So,
Well, nobody sheds any tears for the Japanese or the Germans or the Italians who were interned in America or Canada or Britain or in the Soviet gulags, but all of the tears are shed for Jews who were put in camps for reasons that you just mentioned. I wish none of it ever happened. I wish the war never happened and nobody was put in any concentration camps. But we have to look at the root causes for why these actions were taken. And then there's this idea that Hitler was wanted to eliminate every Jew in the world. Okay, now let's address this.
That's just not true.
Issue.
It was not extermination. It was relocation. He wanted them to leave. But the funny thing about this whole this whole deportation thing is that the Jews who were living in Poland from 1933 on, the Jews in Poland had it much worse there than the Jews in Germany. And in fact, a lot of Jews from Poland moved to Germany.
during the reign of Hitler?
Yes.
Wow, yes. That's something that will shake up some people who have never encountered this information. I mean,
sure. I talk about that in my third book.
And then there's most people have no clue about the pact between Hitler and the Zionist groups to transport Jews and property to Palestine, the Havara Agreement. Now, the fact that this existed and the extent of it, it completely throws for a loop the official story that Hitler wanted to eliminate every Jew in the world. Now, if he was from the outset hell-bent on that policy, then why would he make agreements with Jewish groups to basically facilitate the transposition of German Jews to Palestine, which coincidentally actually helped in the formation of Israel through the funneling of agricultural equipment and capital into Palestine. So they were quite happy to. In fact, the Zionists, when we really look in the history of it, all of the terminology used that people associate with, you know, extermination, like the final solution of the Jewish question, this is a term associated with Hitler and the Nazis, that as if they originated this phrase. They didn't come up with this phrase. This was a phrase used by Theodor Herzl in his Zionist Manifesto, and what they meant by it was transporting European Jews to Palestine to create the State of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But they recognized then, about 1938, that, oh my gosh, we're not doing Palestine any big favors, and so they stopped doing the deport. Well, they weren't deportating them. They were saying, if you want to go, you can take your stuff, you can take your assets. If you sell your property after you leave, then we will put it in the bank. There was a bank set up. Now in this country, when, like in 1952-54, when the American government wanted to get rid of a lot of Mexicans, they just rounded them up, took them to the border, and said goodbye. And just let them go off in the desert and make their way home by themselves. But with the NSDAP and the German government, they actually allowed them to take their stuff. And they did not expel. A lot of people say, oh, in 1933 era, all the Jews had to leave Germany. That is just not the case. They said, if you want to stay, you can stay. If you want to go, you can, you know, we'll help you go. But they certainly did not kick them all out. There were those that left because what they did do is say, okay, the Jews are not going to be in charge of the banks anymore here in this country. They are not going to be in charge of the medical schools. They are not going to be in charge of the theater. They are not going to be in charge of the newspaper. They decided, hey, these are aliens. These are not these a lot. And besides, a lot of the Jews in Germany at the time had come into Germany after World War I. And they came into Germany to exploit the sad, bad, terrible circumstances that the Germans found themselves in after World War I. They were starving. We mentioned the Versailles Treaty. And one of the stipulations of the Versailles Treaty is that, Germany had to sign it or else the blockade would remain. And even after Germany signed the Versailles Treaty, and it was the November criminals who signed it, and by the way, they were Jewish, and they signed it, and Britain did not remove the blockade for 9 months. They continued to starve the Germans, who were literally dying like flies, and we're talking about little kids starving to death, and people living in cellars, bombed out cellars, and then all of these Eastern European Jews came in and were buying up property, from desperate Germans. And so what the problem was Hitler said, okay, if you've lived here for a number of generations, you're perfectly welcome to stay. But they encouraged those who had just come in since 1917, 1918, they invited them to leave. And that is what they did. And I want to also get back to the Polish issue. With the war beginning, it began on September 1st, 1939, and it really was not the Germans who attacked, because the Poles were militarily superior. They had superior weapons, superior ships. They were superior. They had more weapons than the Germans. And they had been doing sorties into German territory for months before September 1st. The other thing that was happening is the persecution of the Germans that were living in Polish territory. Now, remember, Poland wasn't always Poland. It became Poland after World War I, and it was created after World War I. And the Germans who had been living in German, part of Germany, who had been living there, all of a sudden were now under the jurisdiction of people who hated them. And this hatred of Germans for the Polish hatred for Germany goes back a long time.
So you're saying that Germany had more of a raison d'etre, so to speak, to go into Poland than the Soviet Union did. But there's all these narrow criticisms leveled solely against Germany that could easily be leveled against others, and it's not. In fact, that those criticisms are suppressed, and again, we find this very narrow and simplistic narrative forming that only Germany's at fault for these actions. But what would you say to the people who would argue that the joint Soviet-German invasion of Poland was sort of a part of this Ribbentrop-Molotov pact divvied up certain portions of Europe and under German and Soviet spheres of influence?
Well, I talk about that in my book. And the reason that Germany made a pact with Russia to begin with is because they wanted to prevent war. Because they understood that, well, Russia was, the Soviets were, had their eye on Germany. And things were not going well with Britain. They didn't want a double-sided war. They did, so they made a pact with Russia. And Russia actually made the pact in order to kind of get rid of Poland, because Poland, it was the country that separated Germany from Russia. It was kind of this little
buffer zone.
Buffer zone. And so they just didn't want to fight a two-front war.
Well, people would argue, though, that if that was the case, then Hitler actually did attack the Soviet Union in 1941, Operation Barbarossa, and did create a two-front war.
But the Soviets had been lined up at their western border with tanks and armies before, and so Germany, it was just preemptive. And they weren't ready. I mean, they didn't want a war. They tried to avoid a war, but had Germany not taken that action, if they had not done preemptive warfare, then the Soviets would have completely overrun all of Europe.
Yeah, these are interesting things. I think Hitler was a pragmatic politician, and he made certain deals with people in order to facilitate his ends. That's the art of politics. You can't just do whatever you want. Now, I don't agree with all of his maneuvers. I don't think everything he did was right or justified. And he did have an idea that, you know, he had a political philosophy and sort of a geopolitical vision for Europe. And,
well,
you know, he perhaps, and then, of course, that you know, wasn't conducive to the Soviet geopolitical aims for Eastern Europe.
He wanted was the land returned that was theirs to begin with. He wasn't out to conquer all of Europe. He wanted to have a force in Europe. And they were, if Germany goes, all of Europe goes. Because Germany and their mentality, their entrepreneurship, their strength, they are the strength of Europe. And Europe and the other European countries would follow suit. For instance, when he kicked the bankers out, and that's one of the reasons that the Jews went after him, is because he kicked the bankers out. And he was going to, and thereafter, okay, while people in America were standing in bread lines and unemployed, the people in Germany were going back to work. He put 6 million people back to work within a couple of years. They had no gold. They had no anything.
No future.
No credit. And they used their productivity to barter. He put people back to work. People who'd never had a vacation ever were now taking vacations. They created the Volkswagen during that period of time, the Autobahn, numerous buildings. He was building the infrastructure of the country. And if other European countries had followed suit, the bankers would have lost their entire foothold in Europe.
Right. The Hollywood depiction that Germany under Hitler was some sort of Mordor dungeon is obviously a cartoonish distortion of reality. You know, I think some of his domestic policies are far more defensible than some of his foreign policies, but his foreign policies were no worse than the British, the Americans, or the Soviets, than his enemies. So any criticism, I would argue that any criticism leveled against Germany in terms of its foreign policies during World War II could easily be leveled even more devastatingly against the Soviet Union, against British and American imperialism. So it's not so much that anybody has to defend everything Hitler did. You don't have to do that. I mean, that's not the point. The point is that there is a massive hypocrisy at work here when we're talking about World War II, where the victors just basically get a free pass for all of their criminal and murderous behavior, including the dropping of two atomic bombs on the innocent people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which has never been rectified. Nobody has ever been punished for those war crimes or the fire bombings that took place in Germany. You know, Bomber Harris, the British, the British bomber who indiscriminately they dropped fire bombs on German civilian cities, annihilating entire populations and some of the most beautiful cities in Europe and turning them into rubble, just as Israel is doing in Gaza today. But of course, all of this is suppressed and buried, and that's and all of, you know, all of Hitler's faults are overemphasized, and all of the criminal actions taken by the Allies are underemphasized, in fact, whitewashed and buried. And that's the whole purpose of revisionism, is to set the record straight, to even out this nonsensical hero worship of these murderous bandits calling themselves world leaders in the form of Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin.
Well, when the American government, the American military go into a country, they go in and they exploit and they steal the resources. Now, when Germany was dealing with other people, it was that they both benefited. Germany had colonies, but they didn't have colonies to exploit. They had colonies to build up. In fact, there was plans to build the Baghdad to Berlin Railroad. So everybody was going to benefit. Whereas the American military goes in and they really subject a country to foreign power. They exploit the resources and the country. They engage cheap labor. They also use the population to experiment on, which they've been doing since the invasion of the Philippines and their smallpox vaccines that they just kind of left over. And the people in the Philippines had never had smallpox ever. They didn't even know about smallpox until after the U.S. military went in and forced them to receive injections. And then all of a sudden you had three huge outbreaks of smallpox. So it's totally different. It's completely different. Hitler only wanted back what was theirs before the Versailles Treaty took away all the land. They they created Czechoslovakia, which was a spear, a dagger, right into the heart of Germany. They gave France a big area,
the Rhineland,
which was the iron.
Right.
They were doing a lot of the production, a lot of the natural resources were there. So yes, he just wanted back what was part of Germany to begin with. He didn't want to go in and do anything else.
Well, the world conquest claim that Hitler wanted to take over the world, even if it were true, there's no evidence that this was true, but even if it were true, it would be no different than the communist quest for world domination or the now American global hegemony, military supremacy. So all world powers and empires want world domination. So this idea, we come back to this very narrow, selective criticism of Germany, which could easily be leveled against other people, and then all the propaganda involved. You know,
their airplanes were not even capable of reaching America. And you hear all the time, oh, if it weren't for America winning the war, we'd all be speaking German. That is so stupid. I can't believe
it. Well, we're all speaking English in most of the world, so nobody complains about that.
Indeed.
Right. So the thing is, you know, there's so much propaganda that's been foisted upon us, and much of it needs to be, we need to continually, address it and dismantle it in order to bring history into accordance with the facts. But one of the more recent things going on is this so-called civil war in Syria, which is nothing more than a destabilization plot to remove Assad from power. And ISIS, this group that the media has been fascinated with for the past several months, just obsessed with this group ISIS. What's your take on this situation? Is this part of the Zionist plot to take over
Absolutely.
The Middle East?
Absolutely, of course. They want power over all of the Middle East countries. And if you have a group that is fighting and presenting a problem, you know that the source of that is like Al Qaeda, something that the American government created, and that is how they operate. They always create these groups, whether they're CIA co-opted kind of groups or whatever. In fact, the CIA was created. It was created from the OSS, which was a group that just caused problems. And so you cause a problem in a country, you say, oh, it's this group of people that are doing this, and that demands U.S. military power go in and keep these people from doing what they're doing, when in fact it's the U.S. a government that actually created the problem to begin with.
So it's like a problem reaction solution scenario,
right?
Where
you
know the problem is first created by the CIA or whoever it is, And then this demands a reaction from the public. The media withholds the fact that where the group's origins are, where sure. it was started, and it just pretends like this just sprung out of a hole in the ground
sure.
and needs to be dealt with. And this, of course, induces the government to come with a solution, so-called, in the form of U.S. military intervention.
Sure.
And the motivation, of course, is not to save anybody from ISIS or being oppressed or killed. The purpose is that there's always an ulterior motive,
sure.
usually economic and also geopolitical. In this case, I would say that the purpose of the U.S. CIA and the Mossad of creating this ISIS, this radical fundamentalist sectarian group who are chopping people's heads off and just causing mm-hmm. chaos and havoc and carnage, is to, one, it serves several purposes. One, it makes Muslims look bad, and this is, of mm-hmm. course, part of the neoconservative agenda to promote a clash of civilizations mm-hmm. between the West and Islam. Secondly, they are causing chaos in countries and causing trouble in countries that Israel wants to destabilize and wants to basically overthrow in
sure.
order to carry out its Oded Yanan plan, its balkanization of the Middle East, fracturing these countries into smaller and weaker states
sure.
so that Israel can rule the roost. And this is what's going on in Iraq. This ISIS group has taken over huge parts of Iraq and Syria and has declared itself a new Islamic state. It's calling itself the Islamic State. And this seems to fit absolutely perfectly in synchronicity with this Oded Yanan plan for Iraq. Iraq, Oded Yanan talked about breaking Iraq into three states, a,
mm-hmm.
Sunni, a Shia, and a Kurdish state in the north. And the Kurds have always wanted to secede. They fought with Saddam Hussein to secede. And this seems to be the agenda of this ISIS group, and they've officially declared on their Twitter account that they're not interested in fighting Israel, that they have we have no issue with Israel, and that they are only interested in fighting, quote, Muslim infidels. How convenient. This group
yes,
is only ever attacking.
Convenient.
They attack their fellow Muslims and destabilize mm-hmm. their fellow Muslims and have no issue with Israel, no issue with the United States. Or now the U.S. claims it's against ISIS. This is just a puppet show, just a window dressing for the real agenda, which is to give the U.S. an excuse to invade Syria
sure.
and remove Assad.
Yep. You know, it's very interesting. People don't understand different cultures. And for years, I mean, we're talking, it goes back to biblical times, is beheading was the method of capital punishment. And,
right.
I mean, it's gruesome, it's terrible, but look at what America does. I mean, we kill more people through via capital punishment than just about any other country, and we incarcerate more people. We have more incarcerated people per capita than any other country in the world. And quite frankly, if the journalist, this sounds pretty cruel, but and I don't believe that they were beheaded to begin with, but if they were in fact beheaded, well, maybe we shouldn't be over there butting our nose into everybody's business to begin with. So if
right.
they weren't there, they would still be okay. But
yeah.
I mean, it's all a puppet show. It's all stage managed, and of course the news that we hear, and I don't listen to the news, but
very wise thing to do.
Right. it's just a bunch of. You know, like I say, it's a bunch of stage-managed
deceptions,
goings on. Yeah, and of course they've already taken out Libya. They've destroyed Iraq. They've destroyed Afghanistan. I mean, we're talking about rubble. And I've had people on my program talking about this, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, what they've done, what the U.S. government has done in those countries is absolutely the most deplorable thing. Killed millions of people, and of course we know who was that woman? Oh, what was her name? She said, "Oh, well, 500,000 children died." Yes, of course. Well, you know, yes,
Madeleine
it had
Albright.
Done. Yes. Madeleine Albright. Oh,
yeah.
What a wicked piece of garbage.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, the chutzpah and the hubris of these world leaders who just shrug off the deaths of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And it's all coming apart, though. Do you think there are any positive developments in terms of public consciousness becoming more aware and open to these ideas and these revisionist points?
Sometimes I think that is true, but when you only have one side of everything, anybody that listens to the television, there's nobody on television that has an anti-war message. I think the last person that did, and he had a very popular program, Phil Donahue, the minute he mentioned an anti-war mentality, despite the fact that he was very, very popular, had wonderful guests, he was gone.
Yeah, and I think so, the same thing happened to Jesse Ventura.
Sure, gone. Absolutely, they're out. So if there's only one message that the American people hear, and if people are not critically thinking, which most Americans don't do, then they are going to buy into what the American government wants them to believe. And even people who you think are very intelligent, you wonder, okay, now what is it? Why do you think that we should go with the army, with the American army? Why should we go over there and kill these people who have not done anything to us? Why should we do that? Why should we give billions of dollars every year to the Israelis who have gone and destroyed, as you said, 500 towns, taken over all of the orchards, all of the land, and killed all of these people? Why would we support a corrupt, murderous, psychopathic state like that? I mean, it just makes sense that you wouldn't do that, but there's such idiotic people that buy into this because they're just plain stupid, or just ignorant, or just brainwashed. Yeah. I guess that you can wrap it all up, and I just get so irritated.
Do you think American American culture, though? I see it here in Canada. It's pretty much the same thing. It's this mindless consumerism. You know, celebrity worship, sports worship, this hedonism, mindless hedonism, and people are only concerned with self-gratification and self-indulgence and just material possessions and money and
stuff.
You know, my friend Josh Blakeney points out that basically what we have today in the U.S. and Canada and many other Western countries is the worst of both the capitalistic and communistic worlds, right? We have obsessive drive for money and greed, and then at the same time, other than the U.S., we have these police state type of policies of hate speech laws and anti-revisionist laws and other acts of the state to suppress people's freedom of speech and freedom of inquiry. So we have a fusion between the worst of capitalism and the worst of communism.
Sure. Well, the Jews invented both. I talk about that in my first book. The capitalism is actually referred to as Rothschild's European plan, and it is one of corporatism. And so what you have is you have corporatocracy making all of the stuff for the Americans to buy. They're feeding into our greed. And as far as being an anti-Semitic country or not having the power to... you mentioned that America still has free speech. That's just not true. Because in 1927, with the Radio Act of 1927, which was implemented by the Secretary of Commerce at the time, which was Herbert Hoover, who always worked for the Rothschilds. Ever since he graduated from Stanford University in 1894, I believe, he went to work for the Rothschilds. And so from 1927 on, you had the U.S. government literally deciding who was going to have access to the American airways, which is public. It's supposed to be public. But you had, from that point on, and then on through the Reagan administration, who finally got rid of the fair and balanced, yeah. So that you only have one side of an issue. Mm-hmm. So we are, by that law alone, we are self-censored.
Yeah.
We politically correct. You have to be politically correct. Right. If you're not, then people are going to avoid you. You can't say anything bad about the Jews simply because we have to be politically correct.
Right, it's sort of a soft censorship in America. The difference is that in America, you'll never go to jail for something you say for quote unquote hate speech or something that you
question. In jail for, yes, they will do that. In okay. fact, Edgar, gosh, my mind's a blank.
Hoover?
No. Give me a minute. He just died. He was Steele. Edgar Steele.
Oh,
just died in prison. He was put into mm-hmm. prison, I want to say, in 2000. Let's see, that would be 2010. The end of 2010.
Right, this was the American lawyer who
was framed
for allegedly trying to assassinate his own wife, and it turned out to be
an FBI
sting operation.
Yes, it was a sting operation because he was a very successful lawyer. He defended people, various people on free speech, mm-hmm. you know, issues, and he also talked about the Jews. He talked about the white population being mm-hmm. Slowly disseminated or eliminated, mm-hmm. and so they set him up.
Yeah,
and then you have other people like. Just a lot of people who have been put in jail, but you're never going to see it on the evening news. So people think, oh, no, you can say pretty much anything you want to, unless, of course, they set you up and put you in jail and let you and right. withhold vital health care from you, and then you just die.
Yeah, it takes a lot more effort for the American state to be able to railroad somebody into prison through these underhanded methods,
sure.
or subversive methods,
then
it would be.
Or you criminalize things. You criminalize, say, smoking pot or whatever.
Right.
I mean, people go to jail for life for smoking pot, but they can commit pedophilia, and get out in 2 years, or not go to jail at all, or.
Yeah.
Or you can be a politician and do whatever you want for as long as you want, as long as you have the campaign funds, and as long as you do what what other officials tell you to do,
yeah.
Then you can be corrupt and get a pension for the rest of your life.
Yeah, it's sort of a subtle creeping tyranny being
sure
developed,
it is.
And you know this. Anybody who supports freedom of speech and freedom of inquiry should be getting involved in these type of issues and,
sure.
and start speaking out about it. And there are very few, but the ones that are interested in these topics are quite active, such as yourself. You've been doing this for many, many years, and you're still writing, you're still doing radio, and this is a great benefit for humanity. I think in 100 years there should be a Diana Spingola statue put up in front of the White House.
Yeah, probably with a rope around my neck.
Take down the menorah and put up the Diana Spingola statue. Anyway, we're verging on an hour and a half.
Oh.
I'm going to wind it down here. So where can people find your writings, your articles, and your books? I believe you have a website.
Right, Spingola.com mm-hmm. and SpingolaSpeaks.wordpress.com.
So your books are available on Amazon. The title
yes,
is
they
the,
are.
The Ruling Elite. So if you want to order Diana's books, just go to Spingola.com or go to Amazon and type in The Ruling Elite, and they should come up. And you're also working on another book, another fantastic book, which should be done soon, or...?
Yes, hopefully within a month.
That's great. So I want to thank you so much for coming on this very first episode of the Non-Aligned Media Podcast. For those listening, I'm your host, Brandon Martinez. For more interviews, articles, and analysis, you can go to nonalignmedia.com. Thanks once again for listening.
Thank you.